I'm here with Dr. Kenneth Brookler that was yesterday, in Manhattan. And we're going to talk a little around hyperinsulinemia and its connections to tinnitus and disorders of the inner ear. And actually, Ken, delighted to be here again.
Oh, thank you. Nice to see you here again.
Yeah, it's great. And I just came from Chicago where we interviewed our Dr. Joseph Kraft. And he's actually 95 this month, so I know he's a friend of yours, you'd be aware of that.
Right.
And basically, we had a great conversation, and we'll release it later. But his work on hyperinsulinemia and showing really that a huge proportion of the population are actually hyperinsulinemic following a glucose load. And he defined that as essentially diabetes or diabetes in situ. So something people mightn't realize is if you do a very accurate test like Kraft's, you do an oral glucose tolerance and then you get the insulin response, you actually find out that 70 or 80% of people, even with normal glucose measurements, are hyperinsulinemic. And that correlates or links to a whole range of chronic disease, including
I think the literature shows that if you can have a diet high in concentrated carbohydrates for 10 to 15 years, your body's insulin will keep your glucose at a normal level. Mm. And then somewhere around 10 to 15 years is when you begin to show up with type 2 diabetes if you don't make a change in your eating habits. Mm. But it can take up to 10 to 15 years.
That's, yeah, exactly it. And of course, if you could do a test like Kraft developed, who's the father of the insulin assay as such, you can see 10 or 15 years in advance that process is beginning.
It's an evolution, right?
Yeah, very good. And an interesting thing, well, it's more than interesting, it's kind of tragic. Dr. Kraft's work has not really been acknowledged or accepted generally in the medical community. However, way back, the ENT community, including yourself, I believe that's how you met him, actually he gave some talks and you took it on board quickly.
Well, my recollection of the trail is that there was an otolaryngologist practicing in Poughkeepsie, New York, by the name of Updegraff, and he got interested in doing glucose tolerance tests, and he discovered Kraft's work. And Updegraff, for a period of time, was involved with what I call the Busy Doctors of Europe. So there's a group that at the time was based in Bad Kissingen, Germany, that met in Germany in even numbered years, in odd numbered years. It was all over the world, from India to South America to the United States, etc. And at one of those meetings, I met Kraft. Now, I had become aware of his work because somewhere in the, not quite sure, the 1970s, I got introduced to the idea that some of these inner ear disorders could be diet driven. I came out of my fellowship as a skull-based surgeon, and all the only ways you could fix problems with the inner ear was with some kind of an operation. And so some of my friends, small group of ear, nose, and throat doctors, maybe five or six, whenever we had a national meeting, we would meet in somebody's hotel room and discuss these kind of things. And I got invited along because I was the surgeon, and I kept looking at this stuff, and finally it started to be quite compelling. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that a friend of mine in New Orleans was using a 5-hour glucose test monitoring the balance system. So what he would do is he would hook up people, we could measure eye movements, it's called nystagmus, as a sign that the balance system isn't working normally. But instead of measuring, although he did, instead of just measuring the glucose and insulin levels, he also measured what was happening to the eye movement. Mm. And in the process of doing this five-hour test, he found that there was a correlation that the balance system was getting stimulated, and although the patient may have been symptom-free, that this was a sign, an actual very subtle sign, that, that the balance system was already being affected by just this situation where somebody's sitting in an office for a five-hour test and their balance system's not working normally. So I decided, though, I'm going to start looking at these things and getting a five-hour glucose tolerance test with simultaneous insulin levels. And so I started looking at that. And actually, early on, some patient came up with an insulin that was so high that I was sure their pancreas had a benign tumor that was producing high levels of insulin, and sent them from an MRI scan of their pancreas, not fully understanding the insulin levels that could actually be produced by somebody's diet. And also, going along that trail, I would have my surgical patients that did not respond as they hoped they would with their operations. I said, okay, well, let's take a look and see if there's anything else going on. And among the metabolic things I looked at, as well as thyroid tests and the lipid tests, was the five-hour glucose tolerance test. And it was quite clear that that there was something going on there. And at that time, I had known this diet doctor in New York who had a couple of nutritionists that worked under his supervision. And I said to him, you know, it looks like there might be something going on with the inner ear and these disorders. Can we collaborate in some way and see if we can control their symptoms with diet? So what we did is we selected a group of patients that have a condition called Meniere's disease, which is a well-known inner ear disorder characterized by bouts of severe vertigo, often with nausea and vomiting, with hearing loss, noise in the ear that can be quite debilitating, and it tends to kind of recur. So we selected that group of patients and we said we would do about 50 of them to see what we could come up with. And rather than having the patient see him as the patient, he said, all your patients are fully worked up by you. We can just go directly to my nutritionist. So we made a kind of a low level cost way of doing this. And lo and behold, I think we reported the results, which were terrific, back in 1984 at another international society for dizziness called the Barony Society. I think that was back in 1984, and it was published, subsequently published as well. And so that was the beginning. And then as I went along, it became clear that maybe instead of operating on people first, I should really put them on the diets first. And lo and behold, after a while, I put myself out of business. But I was still surgery business, but I was still not quite sure about where the insulin levels fit. And when I met Joe Kraft, he basically set everything out, and it was very clear what your fasting insulin level should be, which your insulin level should be cumulative at the second and third hour, and when to start thinking about when somebody's hyperinsulinemic, because we knew when it was really high that they were there, but we didn't know when they were just on the brink of it and how sensitive the test could be. And he came up with the criteria, and he was in a fortunate position in his laboratory. I think somewhere around 15,000 or 16,000 glucose tolerance tests that he looked at, and he set this straight, and it was very clear that and unquestionable his findings were, and the effect of it on basically treating people.
Excellent. And yeah, that was the amazing thing about Kraft's work, was the kind of specificity that you could really take any human and characterize them, and they're either hyperinsulinemic diabetes in situ or they're not. So that's kind of the ultimate test. Whereas the fasting insulin, it could be down low at around 5 micro international units per mil, and it could be 50-50 whether you have a problem. And I think he had, if you were over 30 units, you were pretty guaranteed.
Oh, a fasting insulin of 30 or more, yes.
Yeah.
And actually, in my practice, that happened periodically. And these are people who basically are just coming with ear noise or dizziness or something like that. And they would have a fasting insulin of 30. And so I would put them on a diet, just follow their fasting insulins until they became normal. Whereas the other patients who had insulins that were higher at, say, the second hour, then I would do a two-hour follow-up, two-hour glucose tolerance test. And generally, I would do that about 3 months after we got them started on a diet, and I would correlate it with their symptoms after 3 months of treatment and see which direction they're going. And so you could use that. But the fasting insulin, if it was elevated, that was an easy one to follow until they got into the normal range.
Yeah, that's a kind of a slam dunk, but there's huge variability in between 5 and 30.
Oh, yes.
Where you need the insulin spike post-glucose to really tell.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And
I believe, actually, you switched Kraft's 5-hour glucose tolerance with insulin assay to a kind of a 2-hour proxy, which is pretty good. It's pretty accurate.
As a follow-up, all my patients had 5-hour, but... I may be getting involved in actually seeing some patients now, and what actually has changed in this country is the reimbursement for laboratory tests. And so, and then by general usage, physicians aren't ordering 5-hour glucose tolerance tests anymore. And basically all they're doing is they're looking at the hemoglobin A1C. And so what's actually happening is the insurance payers aren't really paying for these tests anymore. So in order to get a patient evaluated for the kind of things I'm interested in, then we have to kind of cut the test down to a couple of hours. Now, in my experience, and I don't know how many thousands of glucose tolerance tests were performed on my patients over 25 to 30 years of my doing this, there were a number of patients whose abnormalities didn't show up until the fourth or fifth hour, which always makes me feel a little uncomfortable making a possible compromise going forward in 2015 to just getting a 2-hour test. But we'll basically have to see how that shakes out.
But well, actually, interestingly, Catherine Croft in New Zealand is doing a PhD on all of Kraft's data, which she's analyzed, and she's looking at the indigenous populations who are ravaged with diabetes. And she's trying to see to what extent the 2-hour fully reflects the 5-hour. So that's going to be really interesting. And I think that's under Professor Grant Schofield in New Zealand. So if anyone wants to Google those names, you'll get some detail.
Yeah, and we actually in this country have the same problem with Native Americans.
Yeah.
So it's not. Yeah. So it. And that. And I think it's probably. I think if we looked at the Native Americans 100 years ago, I don't think we would have found it.
No.
But I think it's basically, quote, civilization or whatever term you want to use, availability of all these products that are high in simple sugars.
Yes.
Producing it in the native population.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I was there with a couple of friends, Dr. Ted Naiman and Dr. Jeff Gerber. But interestingly, their Indian extraction patients, almost all, are diabetic. Now, well, I'm saying almost all, but people coming in symptomatic with issues and metabolic syndrome, with the tests that most doctors look at, like HbA1c or fasting glucose, they may technically be okay, but when you bring in C-peptide and other measures, or certainly if you do the glucose tolerance with insulin assay, they all fail outright, or a lot of them.
Well, I became interested in the hemoglobin A1C as it came about. So what I did is I would get a hemoglobin A1C on every patient I had a 5-hour glucose tolerance test on. And I found out how inaccurate what the hemoglobin A1C was in a general way. And I when I look at endocrinologists using it as their barometer of the efficacy of their treatment, I think it's just a puzzlement to me.
Absolutely, and it's ironic that the specialists, if you will, like endocrinologists, are using tests that are, to be quite frank, extremely poor. When the HbA1c is elevated, you're quite late stage. maybe 10 years before that or more, you can flag the problem and react to it with a insulin assay on a glucose tolerance test, but still no one really knows about it. The ENT community may be an exception.
Yeah, and not all the ENT community, because again, it depends upon the education of the otolaryngologist. The people that while they were training were exposed to have said, hey, there can be a metabolic component to this. And part of the problem is that otolaryngology is considered a surgical specialty, and so nowadays they're looking for kind of surgical treatments, and so there's still, but there are a number of otolaryngologists who still believe this, but they are dwindling because the people who got exposed to this in the 70s and the 80s are phasing out of practice, and so the younger guys say, oh well, we have a faster way of doing this now. and I'm not sure it's a better way.
Yeah, well, that's ironic. So people assume that the medical world progresses all the time, and I guess in terms of surgeries and implanted devices and some of the pharmaceutical technology, things have advanced hugely, in fairness. But in terms of fundamental understanding and fundamentals like we're talking about, actually not only is there not progress, but almost going backwards in certain cases.
Well, the Institute of Medicine came out with I can't remember how it was cloaked, but they said it's on average it takes 18 years for a new idea to get into the general practice of medicine. And so I think the example they used was the guy who found the bacteria that produced stomach ulcers, Helicobacter, and he was kind of denounced from the beginning. How could this be an infection? I mean, and just treat it with an antibiotic and go away when we have these great operations. You know, we can remove half the stomach, or we can cut the vagus nerve that'll turn off the stomach acid, and all these other kinds of things. It took him 18 years to get it into the generally, now that surgery's virtually gone because there's no necessity for it, and so that's it's a big problem. And some other ideas may take even longer. I don't know.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And you found, I think I recall that of your tinnitus and migraine type patients, inner ear patients, the high 90s in terms of percent, almost all of them had some level of insulin abnormalities.
Right. Yes. It was, yes, and they're symptomatic related to their inner ear, and we do the study. Now the studies, I classified the 5-hour glucose tolerance test into different types. One was normal, which was quite clear, no significant shifts in the insulin, blood sugars well within the normal range. And the most common one is what I called an exaggerated response, where the blood sugar at about half an hour was over 180. And then it could go even higher at the first hour. And then we'd see somewhere around the second to third hour, a 30 milligram percent drop in the blood sugar was enough to activate something going on in the inner ear. And so that was the exaggerated response. And then there was the clearly diabetic response. And lastly was the flat curve, where the blood sugars don't change at all over the course of the 5 hours, but the simultaneous insulins go up and go down as you would see with the other tests, which was a sign, number one, that the sugar was absorbed, because the first thing you think about is if you got a flat curve, maybe it didn't get absorbed. But the fact that the insulin went up and down was a sign that that the sugar was absorbed, and it seemed that the flat blood sugar could have the same effect as an exaggerated blood sugar. And so it seems that there are variations that go on within our bodies that kind of have an ebb and flow, and if the ebb is greater or if the flow is flatter, that seems to have an effect, at least as far as the inner ear is concerned. On the other hand, it's possible, thinking about it, that the reason why the blood sugar didn't change is there may have been actually an effect of glucagon going on simultaneously, which I think we talked about sometime in the past. So it's not clear, but it was abnormal enough, and it responded to a low carbohydrate diet.
Yes.
Okay. So in spite of those facts, if you put them on a low carbohydrate diet, the clinical response, that is their hearing loss, their ear noise, because of my interest in the balance system, there are mechanisms now that indicate that probably a large percentage of migraine actually is coming from the balance part of the inner ear. And so the treatment of headache related to the inner ear disorders of the patients I saw would also get better with the diet.
Okay, so the low carbohydrate essentially resolved the clinical manifestation, but also it would correct their curves in line with that.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So there you have a direct parallel. Right. You're fixing the apparent abnormalities, which can only really be seen by measuring insulin, as opposed to just glucose.
Right. Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. You can't look at glucose without looking at insulin.
Yeah.
Now the other point, I don't want to kind of leave an impression that this is all, well, it could be, but that it's all related to insulin and blood sugar, because my patients also, many of them showed a change in the density of the bone around their inner ear, and we're also focusing on treating the bone around the inner ear. If their lipids were off, they were also on a low-fat diet simultaneously with a low-carbohydrate diet. If they showed evidence of thyroid abnormalities, those were looked after by the endocrinologist. And then in subsequent years, closer to the time when I stopped seeing patients on a regular basis, we started looking at vitamin D and found that was a factor. Now, going back to the insulin and the bone, there's now research that there's a relationship of insulin to osteocalcin. So there may be an integrated part of this that isn't fully worked out yet. And the molecular biologists in bone are looking at the signaling that goes on in bone, which is a huge amount of signaling. And there is an insulin directed part of this. Also, simultaneously in the bone industry, there's something coming up that bone actually may be an endocrine organ. Mm. So there's a possibility that while just looking at blood sugar and insulin as a separate thing, it may be influenced by our skeleton. And that's still to be worked out, but there's now talking about it in the literature. So these may actually be integrated.
And that's, we spoke last time about feedback loops everywhere, and that's, they're just everywhere, and they're all interacting with each other.
Yes. Now, I think, and I'm actually working on something even newer now, because I've been into these feedback loops. It looks like the human body was designed with no redundancy. So there are a whole bunch of back loops that are in there that are actually working, and there's a signaling system. And a new concept that I'm working on with another project shows that while we think that the nerves carry things in a direct line of the nerve, which is, I think, called the Sherrington concept of neuroanatomy, but there's another way of signaling into the brain that uses the nerves, but in a whole different way, and you can use them for a whole other use. And so there's a lot of redundancy. So and I don't think that what's going on with the blood sugar and the insulin is fully understandable, except it does respond to the appropriate dietary management. So that's the key there.
And of course, the cause and effect chain is naturally complex. But if you're hyperinsulinemic, that's essentially metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance syndrome,
correct,
as you corrected last time. And if you're hyperinsulinemic, it leads to dyslipidemia. So you've got your HDL or triglyceride HDL ratio goes out of whack, you know, your ApoB particle count rises. So the hyperinsulinemia is intricately connected to a lot of the other problems and the osteo, and decoding that will be difficult. There is one thing, Professor Richard Feynman yesterday I spoke with, and he described it as a baseball game, or no, an American football game, which I'm not so familiar with. And he said, okay, there's lots of players and lots of interaction, but insulin is the quarterback. So insulin's the guy to watch.
Right. That's well, yes. And of course, the insulin-resistant syndrome people, and there's papers in the literature, and actually one of the early otolaryngologists actually brought it to my attention, is the endothelial, that's the lining membrane of the arteries, affected by insulin. And so there's a whole group now of cardiologists who believe in the insulin-resistant syndrome, who are actually doing ultrasound of the carotid artery to measure the intima as a sign of what might be going on in their coronary arteries. And so that's all. And then we have polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a hyperinsulinemia, and then non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And then there's some recent things. I haven't been to an insulin resistance meeting in a few years, but I get their notices of what's coming up and what they're talking about. But there's a whole thing now about the kidney being able to control blood sugar. And of course, we know that when the blood sugar is high, it spills. I mean, that was the sign for diabetes in the years of Wilder Penfield or the other Canadian who I'm blanking on right now, Osler. He used to taste the urine, and then he'd say, "Oh yes, this is a diabetic." Okay. So there also may be a control mechanism going on in the kidneys, and we're actually finding now that the kidneys also can produce vitamin D. So there's all kinds of these back loop systems and other ways of controlling things that we haven't even looked into yet.
Yeah, for sure. Someone recently sent me a paper, I think 2015, and it just adds to the mountain of connecting hyperinsulinemia with all of these problems. But they looked at relatives of type 2 diabetics, and they got matched controls from the population, and they connected endothelial dysfunction and vascular issues directly, not only to the relatives versus standard controls, but the extent of glucose metabolism issues correlated with the extent of vascular problems. So this whole web, it's getting decoded, but so slowly, I think.
From what I could see on the bone related literature that I'm really deeply into, is that researchers will identify something and they'll give it a name or some initials or some way of identifying it, and then 2 years later somebody else will find something that looks kind of like it and give it another name or number, and then 5 years later they'll say, "Oh, we were both looking at the same thing, but we gave it a different name." And so you can depending on when you go through the literature, or whether somebody with knowledge has taken that together and say, "Now, what we used to call that and what we used to call that is now this," or we've settled on the name for this. So each individual researcher basically decides to do their research based upon what really interests them. And I don't think that while the National Institutes of Health in this country is trying to pay for research directed at solving problems of the population in this country, I'm not exactly sure that it's necessarily right on track. And part of that has to do with the scientists that are getting grants from the National Institute of Health sit on the committees that decide what health they what projects they should fund, and so it to a certain extent gets kind of inbred. And so new ideas, I think, have difficulty getting the kind of basic research dollars that are necessary.
Right, and for me, there's a parallel. Well, in the engineering world, I work in doing high volume complex devices manufacture. In any program that can run for several years, and there's usually huge complexity in new products, one of the most important roles of all is the technical integrator. So that's a very senior engineer who acts to tie together all the threads, all the issues seen, the technical issues, and ties together all the engineering observations from teams of 50 or 60 or 70 engineers. And that role is just enormously important. But it seems in medicine, as you described there, they don't really have technical integrators. And without that role in my world, which is analogous, it would be a disaster. And in the medical world, it seems
right.
There's an element of that.
So the thing that drives your world is the bottom line of the business you're in. That doesn't drive the medical world, unfortunately, because otherwise somebody would say, hey, it's worth paying for to have this technical integrator or whatever term you want to use.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen. And then, as we had discussed in the past, the people who are funding the research have their paradigm of what they're interested in, and they can't look or consider beyond that, which is another problem.
Yeah, of course, the whole funding and conflicts that are buried within that. I believe in the British Medical Journal, I think something like 76%, in that region anyway, of studies that are in the journal are pretty much fully funded by industry. So, you know, they will be looking for what they're looking for.
Right.
You know, and that's what will come out.
It's creeping in now, because now when people present papers at scientific meetings, they have to state if they have a conflict of interest, at least... in terms of funding sources in their departments or in their research group. And similarly, when papers are written now, there has to be a conflict of interest, but it's a self-stated conflict of interest.
So I think
my conflict of interest is I don't believe in this.
Well, I think there's another problem where once you state, you know, your funding, then it's fine. But whether that's a problem or not, you've stated it, but you can almost just state it and then move on. You're almost lily white. Hey, I've stated it. That's okay.
Right.
Doesn't really do anything. And actually it springs into my mind now. It's probably changing the subject. It's going back to Kraft. But, you know, what I found interesting, he had the, hypothesis strongly believed by himself and a growing number of MDs that I know who have 30 years of clinical observations, that essentially atherosclerosis and this advanced vascular disease is largely, if not exclusively, connected to hyperinsulinemia. And I think Kraft was saying that they acknowledge with diabetes the kidney vascular issue. That's accepted as a sign of diabetes. And he said a failing of medicine is they don't acknowledge that pretty much all the other vascular issues in the vessels, it's the same pathology.
Yeah, and that gets back to that whole effect of insulin on the endothelium of the arteries.
Yeah.
And with its chronicity, what actually develops. Interestingly enough, in the inner ear vessels, you don't really see that.
Hmm.
And that may have, now the blood vessels that go to the inner ear are a part of the vertebral basilar artery system, and which of course is going into the brain, and branches go off to the inner ear, and they may be affected differently.
Yes.
They may be affected differently. I'm not as sure about that. But when they look at the vessels in and around the inner ear, they don't see that. Now they may see it in the more major branches. But the carotid artery, for instance, doesn't feed the inner ear.
Yes.
So there are some differences in whether or not there are differential effects of insulin on the endothelium of different arteries. I don't know.
Right. And I'll expose my ignorance here of anatomy, but is the inner ear, in terms of blood-brain barrier, it's outside the, it's still in the normal vascular system, the inner ear fed, or is it fed via the brain?
No, it's called the blood labyrinth barrier.
Because
the inner ear is the labyrinth.
Yeah.
And there aren't very many researchers in our field that work in this area, but they've named it the blood labyrinth barrier.
Oh, wow.
And okay. So and so the inner ear is a very interesting structure in the fact that it has within it two fluid systems. And the one of those fluid systems is almost continuous with the spinal fluid, and it has the same relationship of extracellular fluid. The inner fluid space, which is called the endolymph, is like the cellular contents of the inside of a cell. So the potassium level is about 120 and the sodium level is around 20 to 40, and that produces a charged battery. It's kind of like an 80 millivolt, as I recall, potential that keeps the inner ear working. So the inner ear is the most highly metabolic organ in the body. Its demands for blood sugar are three times that of an equivalent volume of brain.
Wow.
Consequently, when the ear is not working normally and you have changes going on in the blood sugar, that can affect this what's called the endolymphatic potential. And so some of the researchers would do what's called a patch clamp, where they could actually measure this, and then they could give the animal insulin and see what actually happens to this potential. So there's been a lot of research on that level, and we know that this is the effect, and we also know that's why the inner ear or its symptoms end up being the early signs of something going on before people have some other things. And that may be the reason why Dr. Kraft's work was more accepted by otolaryngologists who understood they were seeing early signs of things. As a matter of fact, years ago when I was going almost every year to the insulin resistance meetings, I proposed a paper calling the inner ear the canary in the coal mine for insulin disorders, and for whatever reason, the program committee didn't think it was worthwhile discussing at that meeting.
they were tragically mistaken, even from my limited knowledge of the topic. But that was a great phrase, actually, because the inner ear, the canary in the coal mine for insulinemic and kind of glucose metabolism. Then we've got diabetes is a kind of a canary in the coal mine with all the heart disease and vascular disease associated. It's the canary for the huge amounts in the population who are actually diabetic in situ.
Right.
It's just that the true, fully diagnosed diabetics who have really gross disruption, you know, they're only reflecting what's happening at a certain level in maybe 60-70% of the population at a lower level. It's amazing. I wonder there, just as I'm trying to technically integrate as we go, but when you mentioned there about the inner ear being kind of a microcosm and it being different and its huge glucose requirements, etc. So I guess if the inner ear is disrupted, it might not be directly by the action of insulin, like the other vessels, but when you have hyperinsulinemia, you've obviously got all the glucose issues. So it's kind of a knock-on effect, affects the inner ear,
right,
in some sense.
Yeah, so I don't think that the researchers got as far as making experimental animals diabetic and then looking at the effects on the blood labyrinth barrier and what's going on with this, what's called this endolymphatic potential. I think they were more interested in trying to understand how the inner ear works under kind of normal circumstances rather than in disease states. But I also had the benefit over time of seeing these people coming in with their inner ear disorders. And I can remember one young man came in and his glucose tolerance test revealed that he had type 2 diabetes. And over the course of a year, he became a type 1 diabetic. So we basically knocked out the beta cells, I guess, in his pancreas with his diet.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know what? You've touched on something really interesting there, Kenneth, is the type 2 diabetics have hyperinsulinemia, and eventually they knock out their pancreas. The type 1 diabetics have hypoinsulinemia, so they need added insulin. But as you add exogenous insulin, which you have to add quite a lot to get the effect compared to if you're releasing from the pancreas,
right.
As you pile on insulin during their life, especially if they're eating high carbohydrate diets and they need, have a big load or need for insulin, they become essentially kind of type 2 because they become hyperinsulinemic from the exogenous.
Right, from the treatment, yes. And the blood sugar is the end point to decide,
yes,
how much you need, and so if your blood sugar is going high, we give you more.
That's it. And if you there's an Irish phrase, horse on. If you horse on, you pile something, a horse on the insulin. But yeah, you're running after blood sugar, which is only the secondary or indicative of the problem. You're horsing on insulin. You're controlling the blood sugar, but now you've got insulin toxicity, and you've kind of removed some of the glycotoxicity. Kraft, I think, even felt that the high blood sugar per se isn't really driving a lot of, say, atherosclerotic disease. It's the hyperinsulinemia more than the, though I'm sure synergistically, when you're running really high insulin and you have very high glucose levels, I'm sure that's a worst case.
Probably, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, a little rant there.
A little rant. So my expertise is only really focused on the in-ear and these other findings I've had over the course of the many years I've run the tests, the testing.
And the just maybe the headaches then, getting back specifically to your experience, the migraine is a major issue. For people who have it, it's really, I've never suffered, but it's really bad. The connection of migraine, you mentioned, is actually maybe more to the inner ear rather than a neurological thing. And in terms of the insulin response and what we've talked about, you see a massive connection there too, I think.
Yes. And I'm planning to do some work on it and get, if I can find some interested neurologists to kind of start to look at their migraine patients outside of their usual headache workup, and to maybe get some tests of balance function, and also start to look at the blood sugar and insulin and see what kind of an effect it can have on their migraine. In that particular domain, as a dizzy doctor, I wasn't a headache doctor in my practice. But early on, I realized there was a relationship. So in my medical record keeping, and I had an electronic medical record, each time if a patient presented with whatever their symptoms were, dizziness, tinnitus, whatever, there was a review of systems. And if they had headaches listed, then I would ask them questions about their headaches and their headache profile before we started treatment. And then when they would come back for the return visits, while I might be focusing, well, so what's happened to your tinnitus? I'd say, what happened to the headaches? And what I noticed over time, and it's just an estimate, is around 80% of them, their headaches disappeared.
Wow.
And so I said, well, you know, looks like there's a connection. And then what had happened back, I must be about 10 years ago, is a childhood friend of mine who lives in Canada called me one day and said, I've had a sudden hearing loss in one ear, and what do you think I should do? And I said, well, what are you doing? And he was getting standard of care for sudden hearing loss. And within a month, his hearing had come back. He let me know. And I said, well, if you're ever in New York, let me see you. So he came by about 6 months later. His hearing was great, as he had said, but I took his history, and he had like a 30-year history, I think it was a 30-year history of migraine, and he was using up to 15 of these migraine drugs a month called triptans, and in between that, he would be using these pills that are available in Canada called 292s, which have a half a grain of codeine in them. To also control his headaches in between the triptans. So I said to him, well, you know, I'm kind of interested in headaches and they could be coming from your inner ear, the balance part of your inner ear, and there may be a correlation with your hearing loss that you had that got better and all of this. Are you interested in seeing if we can find something wrong with your balance system? Which we did. And I said, well, we found that your balance system isn't working normally. Well, why don't we see if we can figure out what's causing it? And so from there, we got the blood tests and the x-rays of the ears and put him on a low carbohydrate diet. I think he had some changes going on that required some treatment for the softening of the bone around the inner ear. And within 6 months of treatment, he was taking half the number of triptans for his headaches. And within a year, I think he was down to 2 or 3 a month. And somewhere between a year and 2 years, they had virtually disappeared. And they have remained gone since then. Although I would see him periodically, and we subsequently found that he was vitamin D deficient, because I wasn't interested in vitamin D early on. And then we also found he had osteoporosis. And so it made it easier for me to keep him on the osteoporosis medicines for his inner ear, because his doctor was happy to treat his osteoporosis with these medications. And he's virtually headache-free. And so this is like, and he would characterize his severe headaches before we put him on treatment as, he called them wall bangers. They hurt him so much, he felt it would feel better if he banged his head against the wall. So, and so those are, you know, this is anecdotal. You know, it's not a series, but and it rings free. And now I've been following the neurologic literature, and there are a group of neurologists at a hospital called Charité in Berlin who believe now that about 80% of migraine headaches come from the vestibular, the balance system, the inner ear. But they don't have the experience of treating the inner ear to get rid of the headache. So they're still using the regular migraine drugs. And then I think something you actually pointed out to me is that somebody had written recently that there would seem to be a correlation with migraine and diseases of the arteries, right? And, and so maybe who knows? Who knows? Yeah. Now, the concept of migraine actually fits with this new redundant system of being able to get information into the brain that doesn't really follow the nerves. And so they talk about, it looks like it may all come together very soon.
Excellent. Yeah. At least that whole kind of segment of the challenge or the problem.
Yeah.
I think the whole web, when you study it for some time and you have access to many different experts, you know, and you can integrate, it's extraordinary, really. So many paths go back to the disruption of hyperinsulinemia through many, many different routes. It's extraordinary, really. It seems fascinating that for 50 years, I guess, the whole system was focused on cholesterol, which is just a secondary. Dyslipidemia is a secondary knock-on, largely, of the problems we've talked about. But with everyone focusing on that, it kind of seems to have drowned out the insulin axis somewhat.
Yes, there's a focus on that, although I think that the dietary trends, at least in this country, seem to be changing, and I think that I think there was a cohort of people that were looked at that I ran across somewhere in the last 6 months or so that indicated that in general the cholesterol and lipid levels are going down. Now the other thing that wasn't really fully understood that became totally clear to me was the triglycerides was totally related to what was going on with the intake of simple sugars and was unrelated to what's going on with cholesterol. And it was really kind of crazy when people started going on these cholesterol-lowering drugs and their triglycerides wouldn't go down. And people didn't understand that particular pathway of the development of a high triglycerides. And the high triglycerides always went along with, usually with a high insulin level.
Absolutely, yeah, they're joined at the hip, and that's where the triglyceride over HDL ratio is a valuable cholesterol metric, whereas LDL level and total cholesterol level are now being kind of discarded. I think they're falling out of the guidelines.
Yeah, or there. Then I noticed recently there's some look at the actual size of the particles, so they're starting to kind of focus on that. And I guess if you have some endothelial problem going on that could be stimulated by insulin, that could be the beginning of developing something in the artery. And I think, as we discussed, there's this fellow, I think his name is Peter Grant from Leeds. He basically showed how an acute coronary syndrome could be set up by insulin, and how the artery actually clogs off as a part of the protective mechanism that's set up in the body. And that's why if you give thrombolytics, which prevent clotting, you could avert some of those kind of spells. And I guess they're seeing that with some strokes now and some other things like that.
Right. And actually, Grant, I need to follow up on Grant. I did follow up with Stout in Northern Ireland, where he connected hyperinsulinemia to the arterial problems. But I need to follow up with Grant for sure. And you just reminded me, and I know we're coming close to the end now, but Dr. Kraft, he was looking also at the myocardium and the tiny vessels in the heart. And with his thousands of autopsies, he was saying, okay, you've got the large vessel disease, which can cause sudden heart attacks, plaque bursts, etc. But then some of the other heart attacks that are based on arrhythmia, that you have all these tiny vessels going through the heart muscle, and there's this extraordinary balance where they keep the heart pumping in the proper rhythm. And the atherosclerosis of those could lead to another path to heart attacks that are not major vessel heart attacks.
Right, so yes, and so they have there's, and I'm not a real heart expert, but they, but if you take a heart without any connection with anything, it'll beat by itself. So it has an inherent thing, and it comes from, I can't remember the term, but if it gets affected by microvascular disease, then it can cause all these different arrhythmias, ventricular tachycardia, which is really bad, and then of course you have, but I don't think ventricular fibrillation does, but with the ventricular fibrillation, you have the heart being inefficient in different places, and some part of the heart doesn't move, and a clot will occur and then get disengaged and cause a stroke or pulmonary embolus or some other kinds of things. Yeah, so there's, yes, yeah, there's the aside from the widowmaker, which is the big big artery in the heart, the left anterior descending, I think it's called. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the big one. You blow that one and chances are you're going down. For sure. But and on that, the microscopic autopsy examination he mentioned has fallen out since the 70s. There were legal issues raised about doing autopsies on patients. So up until the 70s, in medical school, autopsy micro-examination was a big part. And then there was a concern around being sued over permissions. And for 5 or 6 years, there was kind of a wasteland, and autopsies stopped largely. And since then, he said, it's been kind of lost from medicine. And I just found it fascinating that, again, in the engineering world, autopsy of bad and good parts on scanning electron microscope and on a high-powered optical is an enormous part of resolving issues, tying the physical or visual interpretation of what's actually going on with the more clinical or measurement systems and the logic. And it seems like an enormous loss to medicine if people are not tying this all together.
Yes, I think probably people or families or whatever are refusing to have autopsies, even when there's some question of what the cause of death was, only in medical examiner mandated autopsies, usually related to some crime or something like that, do they occur. So the incidence of autopsies has greatly diminished. Now in our field, we have what are called temporal bone banks. Now these aren't banks to give of temporal bones to give to people. The temporal bone banks were banks of information of temporal bones. That's the ears removed at autopsy when there's permission to do a brain examination. And then these were examined, and in fact, there was a whole system in this country where if you had a patient, you had an interesting problem that you didn't understand, and depending on your relationship with the patient, you could ask them to will their bones to investigation upon their death, and this was all in their wills, and it was all set up, and the hospitals where the autopsy or wherever the autopsy could be done had special instructions how to remove the temporal bones. And I think we had 34 temporal bone banks in this country, and part of that was actually supported by the NIH. There are 3 temporal bone banks left in this country, and I don't think they're functioning at quite the level they were in the past. And they end up being a really good resource for things. So I can dial up the National Temporal Bone Bank Registry, which I think is in Boston, and give in a few diagnoses, and they'll tell me how many temporal bones they have with this in it.
Wow.
And yeah.
And if that system, and that's for, okay, that's declining, as you said, and that's for the inner ear, etc. But for the heart, the microanalysis, the heart, the craft is doing thousands of them, and seeing these connections, you know, I guess in the last few decades, there are relatively few people trying to make those connections now. It seems extraordinary, as like we should have progress, but there's probably a lot of key data being lost by not connecting these things there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah,
it's tragic.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Right. Yes. No question.
Well, actually, I'm conscious we've gone on for some time. Do you have any other thoughts or?
I think we've discussed almost everything. Obviously, it's a changing field, and the more people that can get interested in it from all different levels, supporting research, asking their doctor, can this be related to insulin?
Yes.
Just their regular doctor, if they have some symptoms, may help to produce a question in the back of the minds of people that we should know more about this. And the more we know about this, the better we are at preventing disease and helping the world.
Saving the world, that's what it's all about.
Right.
Well, Kenneth, on that note, thank you very much.
Okay.
I'm delighted to meet you again. And as always, excellent discussion. Thank you.
Good.
Thanks, everyone.